Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. We've been having a lot of great teachings past couple of weeks, and lots of food for contemplation, food for nourishing our Dhamma practice, lots of input, lots of things to reflect on. So it's kind of hard to know what to add in an evening's talk. So much has been talked about, presented, reflected on already. I was up at my kuti this morning. I didn't go on Bindabat this morning. A few of us take the day off every now and then because we don't need everybody for Bindabat every day. And so I was up in my kuti most of the morning, walking outside and sitting also, just really enjoying the simplicity. It was a particularly easeful morning, quiet out in the forest, not a lot happening. Just walking back and forth and sitting quietly, watching the different objects pass through, both externally and internally. Yeah, it was nice. It was very non-complicated. Was appreciating the fruits of the practice, being able to live a simple, relatively simple life. We have our complications here, of course, a lot simpler than previous lives I've had, and beautiful setting, nature being in nature, just as a constant reminder of simplicity, things just as they are. Sun rises, the sun sets, the clouds come, the clouds go. Sometimes it's warm, sometimes it's cool, just the natural parts of living in a natural setting like this. And reflecting on how easily it is that things can get complicated too, where human beings, we're kind of prone towards complication. And we have these great capacities of the mind that other creatures don't have, the capacity especially for reflection, consideration, remembering things, and the ability to use that wisely with the teachings that we've been having, mindfulness, clear comprehension, things like that. But these extraordinary mental abilities sometimes get the better of us too, and we get lost in complication, proliferation, and adding layers of difficulty that we don't really need to add. The Buddha describes the process of complication in his dependent origination teachings, the 12 steps of dependent origination, essentially the cause of suffering, cause of difficulty, the cause of complication. Two of the factors in that cycle are particularly noteworthy as places where we can focus some attention as a way of helping to break the cycle, to cause the cycle to disband, and for it to manifest as cessation rather than origination of suffering, cessation of suffering, if we target certain places to break the links. There are several places where one can focus one's attention in the cycle, but two primary ones are around the links of ignorance and craving, ignorance being kind of at the top of the chain, craving being somewhere down in the middle, but realizing that the dependent origination cycle is not necessarily just a linear one, that it is a cycle, and it feeds back on itself in many different ways. But to be able to focus our attention on ignorance and craving as places to help gain understanding and help to let go of the habitual processes that drive this cycle. The references to ignorance and craving come in different ways in the teachings, but are referred to often as the basic root causes of complication, of difficulties. Often quoted phrase of beings in samsara, as we are, obstructed by ignorance and hindered or fettered by craving. Obstructed by ignorance, fettered by craving. So the term fettered by craving has a very strong feeling to it, like a ball and a chain holding us down, keeping us from freedom, this aspect of craving. Oftentimes, craving is discussed in terms of looking at the six sense bases of sight, sounds, tastes, smells, tactile sensations, and the intellect, the mind organ, and ideas. And the aspects, the teachings around ignorance and penetration of understanding, development of wisdom and knowledge are often discussed around the five khandhas. So these are just different ways of grouping experience and seeing how these different hindrances of ignorance and craving can play out in the world of experience. And there's a sutta where Mahakotita comes to Venerable Sariputta and is kind of looking at the world of the experience through the six sense bases, and he asks Venerable Sariputta. He says, "Venerable Sariputta, regarding the sense base of eye and forms, is the eye the fetter of forms, or are forms the fetter of the eye?" And then through the six sense bases, is the ear the fetter of sounds, or are sounds the fetter of the ear? Is the nose the fetter of odors or smells, or are odors the fetter of the nose? And so on with tactile the body and tactile sensations, the tongue and tastes, and the intellect and ideas. Mind and its mind objects. So what he's asking is, he's saying, is the suffering that can arise in the sensory world, you know, when we experience unpleasant aspects of the sensory realm, unpleasant sights, sounds, taste, tactile sensations, etc., ideas, or pleasant ones, when we experience pleasant ones that we want but maybe can't get, is the suffering in the object? Is it in the form? Is the blame to be found in the form itself, or the sound, the repulsive thing that we have to experience by looking at, or the thing that is pleasant and we want but we can't get, whatever it is that's causing the difficulty in that realm of visual experience, or the unpleasant sound of the the dog barking while we're meditating, the bad odors that sometimes come our way, unpleasant tastes, whoever put the sugar or the salt in the whipped cream instead of the sugar, particularly in the realm of ideas, the realm of opinions and views, unpleasant experience, mental experiences that we remember, difficulties that we get wrapped up in. So is the blame in the object? Is that where we can focus and say, that's the fetter therein? Is it with the object? Or sometimes oftentimes that's where we put the blame. We say, that's what's at fault. Or we can sometimes look at it from the internal sense base too. Blame it on. We can say that it's all because I have this body with these senses. If I didn't have to experience things through the eye or experience things through the ear, the nose, or the mind, even that's where the blame is. And if I could just obliterate those, big sensory deprivation tank. Or all the ways that we can try and annihilate the senses, then I would be free. So we do those kinds of things. We try and blot out experience, anywhere from mild suppression of the sense bases, the internal sense bases, through alcohol, drugs, even excessive things, things like excessive sleep. We try and annihilate experience, because we pin the blame on the body, or the sense bases themselves. So anyway, back to the sutta, Mahakotita asks Sariputta, is the fetter in forms, or is the fetter in the eye? Is the fetter in the external object, or is the fetter in the internal sense base? And Sariputta says, well, neither one. And he says, the fetter is the craving that arises in dependence on both. Or he actually uses the words, the fetter is the lust and desire and lust that arises in dependence on both. And I think we can extrapolate that not just in terms of craving, but craving also meaning aversion when it's unpleasant. The difficulty, the pain can be found in that movement of mind that occurs in the presence of the sense base and the sense object. He offers a simile. He says, suppose there's two oxen, a white ox and a black ox, and they're joined together by a single yoke. Can you say that the white ox is the fetter of the black ox, or the black ox is the fetter of the white ox? And the answer is no. The fetter is the yoke or the harness that binds the two. So in that same way, lust and desire or craving or aversion is the fetter that binds the sense base and the sense object. So just part of our practice is really noticing the tendencies that we have when we're complicating things, or when we're experiencing difficulty in the realm of the sense world, including the mind, to try and pin blame on something, internally or externally. And the practice that we pick up to help stop doing that is just to start noticing the process of craving itself. and to start to really understand how it's that movement of mind that wants to get something or wants to get away from something that is the cause of complication, of difficulty. And we put ourselves in a position to start having to look at that more. And you know, the normal tendency would be for the mind just to keep flowing out into the world of the senses to seek what it is we want, or to run away from what it is that we don't want to see or to experience. And the mind's always moving in response to those stimulations, moving outwards. But what we do to help us start to see this process is to impose some voluntary restraints. We take up certain precepts, primarily along the lines of, well, not only the moral precepts, but the more renunciate precepts here in the monastery. Whether we're fully ordained monks or lay folks staying at the monastery, there's plenty of voluntary restraints that we've picked up to help stop the outflow of the senses into trying to get what we want, trying to avoid what we don't want. This creates a very strong mirror for us to see the craving, to see the aversion as it arises before it has the opportunity to manifest in the outflows. And it's not easy. This is not an easy process. It's going against all the old habits. We have to have a lot of patience and a lot of kindness and tenderness and compassion for this process. We don't need to add any more extra layers of self-judgment, of the difficulty around it, of our inability to respond in the way that we would like to. So we whittle away at it little by little, oftentimes making the same mistakes over and over again and watching the mind rebel, resist, put up a fight, wonder what the hell it is that I'm doing here. So interesting that, you know, when we're outside the monastery, we see that maybe there's something to be gotten there, and so we can't wait to get in, and then when we're in, we can't wait to get out. Sometimes it's a daunting process, but in our heart of hearts, we know we've seen enough to say, okay, well, I can't blame the outside world anymore, and I can't just blame existence in this human body anymore. I need to really look at how this movement of mind causes complication, and I'm willing to do that, willing to bear with it, and to start watching a little bit more closely. Because every time that we see a movement of mind about to happen that's going to take us somewhere, that's going to cause complication or difficulty, and we're able to see it and restrain ourselves from allowing the mind to flow out in that way, using our mindfulness, our clear comprehension, our alert, you know, our stick-to-itiveness, our ardency, we allow the impulse to just be felt and seen without being acted on. And we see, even though it's a bit difficult sometimes to just do that and be mindful and watch it without reacting or buying into it, we see that that movement of mind, that craving, that aversion, whatever it is, has a life of its own. It comes into being. We kind of bear with it. We watch it. We open to it. We relax around it. We allow ourselves to experience it. And we watch very closely as it persists and then as it starts to fade and disappear. And all of that can happen without our having to respond in any way to get or get away from. And every time we do that, little by little, we strengthen that muscle. There's that a little victory in not believing the dictates of that movement of mind. And over time, they build up to a point where we're able to catch these tendencies sooner and sooner before they move us into deep complication, deep difficulty, and the sense of lightness and freedom that comes from that, not getting caught in the cycle. Ignorance is the other major area of attention in the cycle, breaking the cycle. And that manifests in different ways in the teachings, of course. The main manifestation of ignorance being ignorance of the Four Noble Truths, just not knowing dukkha, its cause, its cessation and the way leading to it, the ignorance of that whole path, that explanation of difficulty and the path leading to the ending of it is ignorance. It also manifests in other ways, more specific, say, within the realm of samsara, in terms of ignorance of seeing the world around us, and particularly our own nature, not seeing three really big aspects of our experience. Those big aspects of experience being anicca, dukkha, and anatta, missing the qualities of experience of impermanence or transience, unsatisfactoriness, and the nature of the not-self in relation to our experience. This is part and parcel of ignorance. So the Buddha gives us lots of teachings, particularly in the framework of the five khandhas, about how to start to see the truth of these characteristics in a way that will lead to a sense of dispassion for involvement and identification with and taking refuge in the five khandhas. And allowing us to be able to open up to that which is not dependent on conditions. Particularly, I've been contemplating, reflecting on the characteristic of not self a bit more the past number of weeks. A lot of the teachings that Lungpa has been giving keep reflecting back on the aspects of the perception of self and the perception of not self and the ways that manifests in relation to the practice of mindfulness. Insight into not self being one of the major fruits of the practice of satipatthana. So we start to investigate how it is that we create this sense of self around almost all of our experience, in some form or another, whether it's in the form of I am this, or whether it's in the form of this is mine, or in the form of this is myself. Those three major ways that the self-perception can manifest. And we start to challenge that paradigm, challenge that assumption through our mindfulness practice. So a lot of the teachings say on mindfulness of the body, which we spent a lot of time on and we'll be spending some more time on, are meant to sort of help eventually at some point not only reduce the craving around the body and the bodily experience, but also develop the insight of not self in relation to the body. That's why we break down the aspects of the body into components, or look at it in terms of its elemental nature, or in terms of its transience, relative transience, to break down the illusion of an everlasting sense of self, of being able to control the experience of the body. Because it's that sense of control, that sense of refuge and permanence that causes so much complication when it turns out that things are other than always satisfactory or under our control or other than stable. One of the phrases from the Satipatthana that we've heard a number of times is the phrases that go with, say, contemplating the body as the body in and of itself, or feelings in and of themselves, the mind, mental formations in and of themselves. And that's what Ajahn Jeff refers to as sort of the phenomenological mode of perception, which is a way of framing experience that helps us to penetrate and to see the not-self aspect of phenomena. So that we, rather than imputing a sense of self and control and identification with all of these aspects of experience, we start to try and peel that back and just see things in their raw nature, in and of themselves. And I found that just oftentimes repeating that phrase when I'm looking at my own experience is very illuminating. It really helps to point out where it is that I complicate things more than I need to. So if I, feeling a pain in the body, just reflecting, sensation in and of itself. Or craving for some sort of something, food or experience. It's that's just that feeling, that desire, that drive in and of itself. Or particularly when we're looking at, say, aspects of the mind, how easy it is to layer on a sense of ownership or control or lack of control in relation to our mind and the ideas that come through it. Oftentimes we experience a wide range of perceptions, of memories, of mental habits, of moods, emotions, elation, depression, positivity, enthusiasm, negativity, desire, ill will, boredom. All of these kinds of perceptions are part of our experience as human beings. All of us experience them. And if that's not difficult enough, we add this layer of self to it, of me. We take ownership. we assume ownership of it, and we complicate things even more by saying, I'm an awful person, or I'm just such a depressed. Why am I so depressed? You know, why am I so angry? Why am I so lustful? What is this boredom? It's, what am I doing to support that? Why can't I get this under control? I've been meditating for 15 years and I still have this problem. So not only are we experiencing these things, but we are adding what's called the second arrow of suffering by layering judgment and evaluation based on a perception of self, based on a perception that we should have more control over this, that we should be able to deal with it skillfully and see an end to it. And we set a standard and we don't measure up to it, and we beat ourselves up even more. And then sometimes we see that happening and we say, I've got to stop doing that. So we just added another. We've added the third arrow. And on and on and on it goes. So just teasing that apart, decomplicating things. Don't need to do it. And just looking at, mood in and of itself. There's some reason that it's there. There was something set in motion a long time ago that is causing this to arise in my experience. Don't know what it is. It's not worth trying to figure out. But how can I be with it just as it is right now? Can I bear it and not complicate it even more? So we put our mindfulness, our clear comprehension, put a lot of effort into just being present and to seeing it with clarity. Watch it arise. Watch it persist as long as it does. Don't complicate it. Don't add layers of me and mine, self to it. And then we watch it fade away. The more understanding we can get around that, the more often we see that happening, the less of a grip it has on us. And we learn to relax that whole I-making, my-making aspect of complication. So just even spending the day, with the intention to watch the mind, watch the activities of the mind, the moods, the thoughts, and to greet each one of them with in and of itself. That's just what it is, arising and passing away. I don't need to take ownership. I certainly have to respond in some skillful way. But even that response, I can see it's not me, it's not who I am. It's a skillful habit that I can, with effort, with right effort, with attention in the right place, can develop. I don't have to take ownership of that. But I can develop it. And you can start to see even the subtle aspects of mind, the subtle aspects of our experience are just these kinds of mental factors in and of themselves. Even it's so easy to form a sense of identity around some of them, even things like the mental factor of intention, for example, is one where it can be a lot of self. When you think, oh, well, I've got at least a little bit of choice in how I respond to the world. We do have a modicum of choice in how we respond and where we set our intentions, where we put our attention. And it's easy to get kind of caught in the illusion that's who I am. I'm the one who can make good intention to steer my attention in a more appropriate way. So even if we don't have that actual conceptual thought, that feeling, that perception is layered onto that mental process. But when we are quiet and can watch the process happening, we can even reflect, even these subtle layers of intention, attention, other mental factors, they're dependent on having developed these qualities in the past. They're dependent on watching the mind and its manifestations with mindfulness and clarity, alertness, and the attention turns towards those skillful habits that we recognize bring a sense of well-being, a sense of confidence, that we can retrain this whole process into more of a skillful endeavor. We don't have to be at the mercy of greed, hatred, and delusion. But it's all dependent on repetition and mind training and the quality of mindfulness. And looking at that in a way where we don't have to identify with it, but we can still encourage it and nurture it and feed the process with things that keep it going, the right effort. So this is where you can see the teachings, say, of what Lung Pao has been talking about, right mindfulness, right effort, right view, revolving around each other in everything that we attend to, right through and including this contemplation of the perception of not self, and how that helps to decomplicate things, helps to bring simplicity. We start to let go of these layers of selfhood, selfing, that we get ourselves involved with, just by seeing phenomena in and of themselves, sights and sounds and tastes, all the experiences of the senses in and of themselves, the body, just as it is, without adding layers of complication and opinions and views and desires, the mind, all the habits, the ways that we react, the resistance, the wanting to get away from, the wanting to get. All of these things are just experiences that arise in and of themselves. No need to complicate them with a sense of ownership, a sense of me, a sense of self. So when we start to do this, it's a process of relinquishing, of letting go. It's a process of decomplicating, of living life on a more simple level, of seeing things just as they are, enjoying the simplicity of letting go, rather than trying to create. And the potential is that we have the ability to do that completely. And when we're able to undo, untie the fetter of craving in the sense world and in the realm of the mind, and when we're able to penetrate all the various aspects of ignorance, and to develop clear seeing, clear knowledge, and an understanding of how we create dukkha in our minds unnecessarily, we see these and we start to let go, turn away from these old ways, and be able to relax, open up, and relinquish any wish to keep ourselves involved in this complication, in this complicated process. And the potential to completely let go of that is there. And in the meantime, we just enjoy working with it little by little, experiencing the fruits little by little, one drop at a time, trying to give ourselves a lot of space and time and permission to explore this and to gently and slowly learn to let go. So I think I'll leave it there for tonight.
Sa